Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. Justice Heck is sitting in each of these arguments but is unable to attend this morning. We have rearranged the order in order to accommodate the judges who are not sitting in the first case. And so the three matters in order of their appearance are docket number 040409, Michael T. Willis, Francie Willis, Urban Retreat of Houston, and Willis Heights Enterprises, Inc. versus Dan Donnelly from Harris County in the First Court of Appeals District. Justices O'Neill, Brister, and Medina are not sitting in that case. Number 040194, MZ T. Barker and others versus Walter W. Eckman and others from Harris County and the First Court of Appeals District. And 040432, Moki Mac River Expedition versus Charles Drug and Betsy Drug and others from Dallas County and the Fifth Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in these matters, and the court will take a brief recess between each argument. All arguments should be completed before noon. The proceedings are being recorded, and the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is ready to hear argument in 040409, Michael T. Willis and others versus Willis Dan Donnelly.
May it please the court, Ms. Marie Gates will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Your Honors, my name is Marie Gates and I represent the petitioners. Your Honors, the issue in this case is whether one who is not a shareholder in the corporation but is merely contractually promised shareholder status is owed a fiduciary duty by the controlling shareholder in a closely held corporation. Now, every court that has come close to addressing this issue has said the answer is no, all the cases we've cited in the chart and our brief. And even our opponents, the respondent, does not deny that the answer to that question is no. The respondent just says that's not the question because the respondent contends that he was a shareholder at the time of the alleged breach of fiduciary duty. But the problem with that argument, Your Honor, is that it lies in the face of several holdings of the Court of Appeals. And if I could refer the court to our timeline, which is tab 2 in our oral argument exhibits that are on the bench, tab 2, our timeline, the first holding of the Court of Appeals that it flies in the face of is that there is a breach of the duty, the contractual duty, to make Mr. Donnelly a shareholder as a matter of law, that breach gives rise to damages equal to the value of the shares that Mr. Donnelly was not given.
Let me ask you a threshold question. Mm-hmm. Is there any dispute about whether Donnelly earned the right to conveyance of the stock?
Your Honor, with respect to the corporation's obligation to issue to the stock, there's no dispute except for the fact that there was an agreement between Mr. Donnelly and Mr. Willis to postpone making him a shareholder. And that's the agreement that the Court of Appeals relies on to find that the obligation to make him a shareholder didn't accrue until November 94. And that's really my third holding that their argument flies in the face of. The Court of Appeals says the obligation to make him a shareholder did not accrue until November of 1994. That's the yellow bar on my timeline, November 1994. And importantly, Your Honors, the respondent does not contest that holding. And we don't contest that holding. It's uncontested before this court that the obligation to make Mr. Donnelly a shareholder accrued in November of 1994. And the reason for that is the Court of Appeals says it was undisputed, and Mr. Donnelly admitted, Mr. Willis testified, that they agreed to postpone making him a shareholder so Mr. Willis could get the tax benefits of being a sole shareholder, and they agreed to postpone it until the corporation turned the corner financially. And at this record, the corporation has never turned the corner financially. So the Court of Appeals holds that when Urban Retreat terminated Mr. Donnelly's employment, that was a repudiation of the contract, Justice Willett, and that accrued the obligation to make him a shareholder, which had not accrued up till that time. And you see, that's why their argument that he was a shareholder at the time of the alleged breaches of fiduciary duties doesn't make any sense. Because look at the breaches of fiduciary duties.
What about these repeated, allegedly, these repeated verbal assurances and promises
Right.
He would convey the stock.
Undisputed, according to the Court of Appeals, and not contested by our opponents, undisputed that it was agreed that they would delay making him a shareholder, and that's why the Court of Appeals, in its statute of limitations holding on breach of contract, says that cause of action accrued in November of 1994. And if I could point out, Justice Willett, without that holding, their claims probably would have been time-barred, and that's probably why they're not contesting that holding. They need that holding so their contract claim won't be time-barred. But nevertheless, what the holding results in is that the obligation to make him a shareholder doesn't accrue until November 94. That's the yellow bar. But the red boxes on my timeline are the breaches of fiduciary duty. According to the Court of Appeals, what are the breaches of fiduciary duty? Mr. Willis making loans to the corporation instead of capital contributions? That's the red boxes on my timeline. Mr. Willis and Francie Willis purchasing the realty? That happened in 1992. Purchasing the realty when the corporation had an option to purchase the realty, allegedly usurping the corporation's opportunity to purchase the realty. All of those red boxes, which are the breaches of fiduciary duty, occur prior to the time when the Court of Appeals holds the obligation to make him a shareholder had even accrued.
So if you just have the right to stock, but it doesn't actually physically arrive, then any fiduciary breaches don't apply?
Chief Justice, he didn't have, according to the Court of Appeals, he didn't even have the legal right to the stock until November of 1994.
Well, your third bullet point here says the calculation for breach of contract should reflect the value at the time of injury. That's the time of termination. Is that different from when the right to be a stockholder?
The date of injury, we agree with that part of the Court of Appeals opinion, Justice.
I know, you just said that. I'm asking, is there a difference between the determination of when the injury occurred or when the breach occurred versus the time when there was a right to be a shareholder?
No, Your Honor, I would say that's the same point in time. And the right to be a shareholder, in this instance, I understand under the letter agreement it might have accrued earlier, but because of the undisputed agreement of the parties to delay that accrual, to delay his right, according to the Court of Appeals, undisputed by the parties, his right to the shares did not accrue until November 94.
Did the parties agree that November 94 was the date that Donnelly received the stock, or was that a determination by the Court of Appeals?
The parties agreed in the sense that Mr. Donnelly and Mr. Willis both testified that they had agreed to delay making him a shareholder.
To what date?
And then the parties agree here before Your Honors, because nobody's contesting the Court of Appeals holding that's the date when the shares were due.
I understand those two points. Did the parties agree?
Right.
To delay the shareholder status of Donnelly to a specific date, or did it just agree to delay that time?
The specific date, to the extent it existed, was when the corporations turned the corner financially, and the corporations never turned the corner financially. And that's why the Court of Appeals holds that, yes, but when Urban Retreat repudiated the contract by firing Mr. Donnelly, by terminating his employment, that accrued, because of the repudiation of the contract, that accrued the obligation to make him a shareholder. That's the undisputed holding.
I thought that the amount of sales was what the triggering element was to make him a shareholder.
Your Honor, under the letter agreement, that's true. But for the separate oral agreement of Mr. Donnelly and Mr. Willis to delay making him a shareholder until the corporations turn the corner. You see, and that, the Court of Appeals says, is undisputed. Okay? And my opponent's not disputing that here. They don't dispute the accrual holding of the Court of Appeals. So, but let me say, let's pretend he was a shareholder, because I want to answer that issue too. I don't want to just stand on my argument that he wasn't a shareholder, but I think that's exactly right, okay? But let's assume he was a shareholder. Let's take him outside of the corporation and let's put him inside the corporation and make him a minority shareholder. And then ask yourself the question, under Texas law, is there a direct fiduciary duty for a closely held corporation? Is there a direct fiduciary duty owed by the controlling shareholder to a minority shareholder? Because that's the issue that they want Your Honors to answer. And we believe the answer to that issue, properly understanding the Texas cases, is also no. Is also no. Now, why do I say that? Because if you look at the Texas cases that have recognized a fiduciary duty, they say this duty by the controlling shareholder to the minority shareholder only exists in limited circumstances. And what are those limited circumstances? It's all situations where there's an injury to the minority shareholder that is not also an injury to the corporation. Take Your Honor's decision, this court's decision in Patton versus, I forgot my second name, the patent case that cited, Nichols, patent versus Nichols. That's the only Texas Supreme Court case either side has here on this issue. Malicious suppression of dividends. The controlling shareholder maliciously suppresses dividends. That's an injury to the minority shareholder, but it's not an injury to the corporation. It's only an injury to the minority shareholder. And what did this court say? An equitable remedy to enjoin the controlling shareholder to issue dividends was available. So what are the limitations on this duty? It has to be an injury to the minority shareholder, not an injury to the corporation. And generally, it only gives rise to equitable relief. What's another case? Davis versus Sharon, the first court of appeals case cited in the briefs. Malicious locking out, malicious attempt to push out the minority shareholder. That's an injury only to the minority shareholder. It is not also an injury to the corporation. Equitable remedy only, enjoining the controlling shareholder to buy out the minority shareholder. And this distinction that I'm positing, that I'm proposing to your honors, was beautifully laid out. I couldn't say it any better than Judge Hal Cobb said in the Shawty case. Federal District Court Judge Hal Cobb, it cited, your honors, in our petition for review, and I'm embarrassed to say it is not recited in our brief on the merits, so please don't miss it. It's in our petition for review, the Shawty case. And here's what Judge Hal Cobb says. Texas courts have properly limited the scope of the majority shareholder's fiduciary duties because most abuses of majority control constitute breaches of fiduciary duty that the majority shareholder owes to the corporation, not to the individual shareholder directly. And in this case, in Shawteet, the alleged abuse of control was the use of corporate assets for the benefit of the majority shareholder, exactly what's being argued here. And Judge Cobb goes on to say, these allegations, if taken as true, would constitute breaches of duty which the majority shareholder owed to the corporation, not to the minority shareholder. And whether the minority shareholder is damaged by the breach is irrelevant.
What's the current status of URH and WAG? Are they defunct? Do they have assets?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What's the current status, financial status of the two entities, URH and WHE?
Your Honor, all I know...
Are they defunct or...
Oh, no, they're ongoing. Viable? They're ongoing entities, Your Honor, but all I can tell you is what's in the appellate record, and what's in the appellate record is they were still losing money as at the end of the appellate record.
Are you arguing that the companies aren't liable under the letter agreement?
No, Your Honor, I'm not. I'm when I get to the breach of contract claim with respect to whether the companies were obligated to issue the stock, now, the claim has to be remanded because it was tried under the wrong measure of damages. But I'm not arguing that the corporation is not liable for issuing the stock in the breach. It has to be retried. But I am going to argue when I get to the breach of contract that Mike and Francie are not individually liable on the breach of contract. But for the fiduciary duty, I am arguing that there is, as a matter of law, no fiduciary duty owed in this circumstance by the controlling shareholder to the minority shareholder because of the nature of the injury that's alleged here and because of the nature of the abuse of control that's alleged here.
Two questions.
Yes,
you agree there's an equitable shareholder doctrine. And then second, is the equitable right to possess stock the same as actual ownership?
Okay. Yes, sir, I agree that there's an equitable title doctrine.
Where is that? Is it in Texas? Have we said that? Supreme Court.
The Neely case that they cite, the first court of appeals case, comes the closest, Your Honor. And basically, if you have, if it was time to give him the stock, if he was entitled to the stock, he would have an equitable title. Now, Your Honor, maybe I answered your question erroneously because I do not agree that even if he was an equitable owner of the stock, that he would be owed a fiduciary duty. See, that's what they're arguing. They're trying to argue he had equitable title and therefore he's owed a fiduciary duty. I don't care if he had a legal title. My point is that under Shawteet and a correct analysis of the Texas cases, no fiduciary duty is owed for this type of injury. It's not an injury only to Mr. Donnelly. These alleged breaches of fiduciary duty where Mr. Willis usurps a corporate opportunity, according to them, because he buys the land that the corporation had the option on, or Mr. Willis doesn't make capital contributions, instead he makes loans to the corporation, that's an injury to the whole corporation. That's not an injury special to Mr. Donnelly. And that's why there's no direct fiduciary duty owed.
What does the record show us about the story behind the story on the crossing out of the name?
Your Honor, yes, sir, you're on the breach of contract claim. Let me talk about the breach of contract claim.
Mr. Yates, before you change gears, the equitable ownership doctrine in regard to stock, does that change in any way your analysis on the November 94 date?
No, and I'm glad you asked me that, Judge, because I meant to say that. Even if he had equitable title, you have to ask yourself, when did he have equitable title? And under the Court of Appeals, a holding, he's not entitled to the shares until the yellow point on the timeline. He's not entitled to the shares until November of 94. So even if he had equitable title, and even if you thought that somehow gave him a fiduciary duty, he didn't have that until after all the breaches of fiduciary duty occurred. So even if you accepted their equitable title argument, they run right into the fact that the accrual holding of the Court of Appeals means he wasn't entitled to the stock until November 94, and that's after the fiduciary breaches allegedly occurred. And beyond that, Your Honor, my position is whether he's a legal minority shareholder or an equitable minority shareholder, for this type of breach, he's not due a fiduciary duty from the controlling shareholder. And one more point on that. We cited, Your Honor, in our booklet, this Delaware Law Review article. It's a relatively new article. It's not in our briefs because it's new, but it's very helpful, and I wish Your Honors would look at it. It's a Delaware Journal of Corporate Law that does a survey across the nation of all the states that have addressed this issue in closely held corporations, and should a duty be owed by the controlling shareholder directly to a minority, and puts Texas in the category of no, Texas doesn't do that. Texas says there's a duty to the corporation, but not to the minority.
But we haven't directly addressed that issue.
Well, Your Honor, except to the extent of the patent case. The patent case, which was the malicious suppression of dividends, where this court held that a duty was owed because that's an individual injury to the shareholder and not to the corporation.
Well, generally speaking, shareholders don't owe each other duties, do not owe each other duties.
Exactly.
Generally speaking. But there's Delaware case law in which controlling shareholders were determined to owe duties to other shareholders. We have not directly addressed that type of a question, not a specific claim or a specific statutory claim, but the general duties owed between shareholders, if any, given special circumstances or unusual situations.
I agree with that, Your Honor, and if you look at that Law Review article, it deals with the Delaware cases, and it points out that really, if you look at the Delaware cases, they're really saying that the duty is owed by the controlling shareholder to the corporation, but not individually to the individual shareholder.
Well, and the question raised here, one question is, if there's a duty by contract, put to the side the agreement to delay the share transfer for now,
mm-hmm.
but if there's a duty by contract for a person to receive shares,
right.
and the controlling shareholder runs the corporation, can
right.
determine when and if those shares are issued, or if they're not issued,
right.
then where do you draw that line? If the majority shareholder is controlling the corporation and the allegation is precluding the issuance of shares that's owed, then it gets a little more complicated than just the black and white picture painted, doesn't
well,
it?
Well, it does, Your Honor, except under the contort doctrine, Delaney's versus Southwestern Bell, you'd have to ask yourself, do you want to create a tort, a fiduciary duty tort, giving rise to actual and punitive damages out of a breach of a contract to make him a shareholder? And remember, Judge Wainwright, even if he is a shareholder, our position is still that no fiduciary duties owe him, because of the nature of the injury here being not a special injury to him as a shareholder, but an injury to the whole corporation. Judge, do you want me to answer Justice Willett's question?
Would you do that on rebuttal, please?
I'm sorry?
Would you do that on rebuttal, please?
You bet.
Give me the date of that Delaware article.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. It's 2004. It's 29 Delaware Journal of Corporate Law, 377, and cited in our book.
Thank you, Ms. James. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Jeffrey Noble, present argument for the respondent.
I'd like to take the time that I have to respond to Ms. Yates' argument and also to cover as much as I can of other issues in the case. The argument that Mr. Donnelly was not a shareholder and did not have the status of a shareholder at the time he was terminated by Francie Willis from the corporation is really contrary to Texas law. The Neely case, which we cited in our briefs on equitable title, it followed this court's opinion in Patty versus Middleton, 1891 case that most of us study in Texas property law, which says that equitable title is the real title. Legal title is a shadow. There are cases in this state cited in our briefs, cases in other jurisdictions as well, that have held that equitable title will support a shareholder's right to bring a suit against a corporation. in a derivative action. And I'll talk about the derivative proceeding issue in just a minute.
Mr. Nellis, real quick. Did the agreement, did the letter agreement by its terms obligate Mr. Willis to do anything individually?
It did. Yes, it did, Your Honor. The agreement itself stated in the first paragraph that Mike Willis is a party to this agreement.
But he didn't sign the agreement.
He did not sign the agreement, but he negotiated the agreement, and the agreement has his name in it. There's testimony cited in our briefs. I don't have time to pull the record reference, but I can't provide that to the court, in which Mr. Willis said that he individually negotiated this on his individual behalf, that Mr. Height was his individual agent negotiating for him in his individual capacity. There was testimony at trial by Mr. Willis that he individually controlled the corporation and individually decided to breach the contract because he, quote, didn't like the deal anymore. There's hundreds of pages of briefs in this case, but all this testimony is laid out in our briefs, and I'll be happy to provide record references for these assertions after argument.
But I agree, the whole point of incorporating is to avoid personal liability.
That's correct. A couple of problems here, and I would, I'm sorry, Judge Johnson.
Would you address the equitable ownership in regard to the November 94 date?
Yes, I will, Your Honor. I'm happy to do that. Ms. Yates' argument is based on a misquote of the Court of Appeals opinion. The Court of Appeals doesn't hold that his right to become a shareholder accrued in November of 1994. Furthermore, it doesn't say that Mr. Willis and Mr. Donnelly agreed that Mr. Donnelly's status as a shareholder would be delayed. The agreement was that stock would not be issued. Physical delivery of legal title will not be issued. But there's no dispute in the record that the right to shareholder status accrued throughout the first few years of the corporation when Mr. Donnelly moved his entire business into this new business. The Court of Appeals correctly held that the contract was breached, but the Court of Appeals did not hold that the breach of the contract when Mr. Donnelly was terminated in November of 1994 was when his shareholder status arose. That makes no logical sense. And furthermore, it makes no real world sense because closed corporations are small, informal, as the record of this case shows, corporations that don't always do their paperwork correctly. That's one of the problems in this case. This corporation didn't do its paperwork right. Because of that, and because Mr. Willis controlled the paperwork, he was allowed to use the benefit of 100% ownership in this S corporation so that he was able to derive tax benefits that were well in excess of $1 million over the time Mr. Donnelly was a shareholder in the corporation and would have had a right to share in those tax benefits.
So what was the agreement between Willis and Donnelly on the delay? Was it delay of issuance of the paper?
Well,
was it delay in shareholder status?
I didn't bring the Court of Appeals opinion to the podium with me, but I believe that it's at 118 Southwest 3rd. I believe it's page 27. I could be wrong. Where there's a quote from the testimony in which Mr. Donnelly said that Mr. Willis asked if I would agree to allow him to delay issuing the stock. But there was no agreement that Mr. Donnelly's status as a shareholder would be delayed. And that's the very important point here. In these closed corporation settings, it's not a muniment of title that creates a fiduciary duty. It is a relationship. As courts have held in this state, when a minority shareholder has a reasonable expectation that things are going to work a certain way in the corporation, and I'm paraphrasing here Davis versus Sheeran, first courts, very, very prominent decision in this area. When the minority shareholder's reasonable expectations are not met because of majority shareholder oppressive conduct, that can be a breach of fiduciary duty. Davis versus Sheeran also has a second element of oppressive conduct, and it's a disjunctive standard, not a conjunctive standard. Either or, either reasonable expectations aren't met, or fair play isn't met, things in the nature of fiduciary duty. And the Court of Appeals opinion, in my opinion, is extremely thorough in discussing the fiduciary duties that arise under Texas law between majority shareholders and minority shareholders in a closely held corporation.
I have two questions for you. What is your definition of oppressive conduct, and how was that proved in this case?
The standard was set out in Davis versus Shearer, where Justice Camille Dunn, in 1988, the first Court of Appeals, synthesized case law from Texas and around the country and said first that oppressive conduct is shown when acts complained of have served to frustrate the legitimate expectations of minority shareholders and were severe enough to warrant judicial relief. The second, and this is a disjunctive, it's not an exclusive list, the second standard is a lack of probity, a lack of fair dealing, and a violation of fair play. And that is certainly what was met in this case, and I believe the Court of Appeals' opinion.
Those two standards are pretty touchy-feely, aren't they?
Well, they've been
lack of probity and fair dealing.
I will say this, Judge Wainwright.
Expectations. How do we add meat to that?
50 cases have followed Davis versus Sheeran since it was decided, and have had no difficulty applying that standard, both in finding oppressive conduct and finding that there was not oppressive conduct. And I think the short answer to your question is to give you the rule that I think the cases have established and the rule that this court could adopt in this case, and that is that in a close corporation, a majority owes a fiduciary duty to a minority when a controlling shareholder is in a position to dominate control of that minority shareholder's interest.
Which is always the case, right?
It can always be the case. It's not. It's a real-world test, as the cases say.
When is it ever not?
What is that?
When is it ever not the situation?
When a controlling shareholder?
In a closed corporation.
Well, I would say that the converse is actually the issue. The Fifth Circuit, in a case that isn't cited in the briefs, but a case called Hollis versus Hill, I'll give you the site in the post-submission letter. In that case, there were 50% shareholders, so each were 50% shareholders. The undisputed testimony was that one of those guys dominated the control of the corporation. And that testimony established a possibility of oppressive conduct through the breach of fiduciary duties.
So anytime a majority shareholder is in a position to control a closely held corporation, the majority shareholder owes fiduciary duties to the other shareholders.
Well, there's limitations. I didn't mean to cut you off, Judge.
No, go ahead. No, there's a
limitation that the cases following Davis versus Sheeran have applied. And I'm thinking particularly of Willis versus Bydolic, a first court opinion by Murray Cohen from 1999, and a more recent opinion from the 14th Court called Alchin versus Kimmick, which is not published in Southwest Third, but was authored by Justice John Anderson on a panel that included Scott Brister. And in both of those cases, the courts were careful to say that unless there is a self-dealing, the taking of a corporate opportunity for personal benefits, unless there's something like that, or unless there's direct injury to a shareholder, that the doctrine doesn't apply. And that's because the business judgment rule protects corporate officers, especially in a close corporation, but in any corporation, from being sued for exercising their valid business judgment. But the limitation on the business judgment rule is that it is not available when a conflict of interest exists between within a transaction that the controlling shareholder is
I'm having trouble a little bit identifying specifically the specific breaches of fiduciary duty by Willis and how those breaches, alleged breaches, harmed Mr. Donnelly. What harm he suffered?
The 14th Court opinion lists several things.
Right. And for example, the purchase of the realty. How did that purchase harm URH if URH didn't have money to purchase the property itself?
I'd like to answer that question, Judge Willis, and I think the best way to do that is to turn to the petitioner's exhibit folder. I don't know if y'all had a copy of this. It would be a poster if they'd gotten to it. I think the very best answer to that question is this, and it is glued to the front of tab 7 Article 5.14L, Texas VCA, derivative proceedings. It adopts the Model Business Corporation Act, as our briefing has said. It also adopts the view of the American Law Institute that in closed corporations, it doesn't matter. A closed corporation is analogous to a partnership in which partners owe fiduciary duties to each other. This statute, the BCA and the ALI article that's cited in our briefing, they all attempt to create a judicial backstop that protects and gives default rights to derivative to shareholders and closely held corporations. The Willises have never fairly responded to the language of the statute, which says that the requirements for derivative proceedings don't apply to closed corporations, and that a trial court has the discretion and the judgment, as was exercised by the trial court in this case. The trial court has the ability to treat a derivative proceeding as a direct action, and furthermore, to provide that a recovery in a direct or a derivative proceeding by a shareholder may be paid either directly to the plaintiff or to the corporations necessary to protect the interest of creditors or other shareholders of the corporation. This statute's been applied by other states.
Looks to me like the answer to it, their response to it, is that it's not effective.
And that's incorrect, Your Honor. And I wanted to point that out, because that's a very important oversight that the Willises have made throughout this case. This statute was certainly in effect at the time of trial in this case. It was in effect 2 years before the time of trial in this case. There was some sloppy legal research done at the appellate court level in this case in which the Willises argued that this statute was not yet effective, but that was a mistake. Court of Appeals saw this in its briefing that we filed in court. But if you look at the session laws that this red font, this mistaken red font is based on, the session laws don't say that this statute wasn't in effect in 1999. The session laws say that it was effective on September 1st of 1997. At the very end of a very long overhaul of the Business Corporation Act and other business organization statutes, at the very end of it, there is a provision that the first court has cited in another case that says that this statute doesn't apply to lawsuits that have already been filed by the time the statute is effective. But that provision doesn't apply to this statute. It applies to the Revised Partnership Act. And I'll give you the cite for that in a post-submission letter. This statute was in effect. The Revised Partnership Act, which for the first time created a right for a limited partner to bring a derivative action, it wasn't in effect, but this statute was most certainly in effect at the time of trial in this case. The Willises' counsel at trial handed the trial judge a copy of the statute. He told them on the record, volume 12, I can't remember the page number, that I'm well aware of the requirements of derivative proceedings. This case did not have to be filed as a derivative proceeding because closed corporations in Texas are not subject to those requirements. And furthermore, trial courts in Texas have the discretion, as the legislature has said, as the ALI has said, and as the Model Business Corporation Act all hold. The trial court has the discretion to say that in a closed corporation, particularly an S corporation like this one, which is the flimsiest form of corporate vehicle, trial courts have the discretion to treat damages that accrue to the corporation or to the minority shareholder as either a direct or as a derivative damage, and that the shareholder can receive it directly so long as other shareholders aren't prejudiced, and so long as creditors aren't prejudiced. And in this case, as we've argued in our briefs, neither creditors nor shareholders were prejudiced by an award of damages to this minority shareholder, Dan Donnelly. So my answer to your question, Judge Green, is that in Texas, in closed corporations, there's no longer a mysterious cloud over the difference between direct actions and derivative actions for closely held corporations. And this has been an issue that has been written on many times in Texas. I have not seen the Delaware article. I've seen it, actually, but it wasn't cited before today. I wasn't prepared to argue about it. But there's a lot more Texas jurisprudence and Texas Law Review commentary that talks about why closed corporations in Texas recognize the majority-minority fiduciary duties. I would say this. Davis versus Sharon itself, the case that the Willises cited in the argument they just made to this court, Davis versus Sharon itself in 1988 involved damages that were owed to the corporation through corporate usurpation, as well as oppressive conduct that occurred to minority shareholders. In this case, we have both things, and there clearly is support in the evidence for a breach of fiduciary duty finding on many, many levels in this case. I'd like to touch very, very shortly, because I'm not sure the lights are working right, but the damages issue in this case is very important. This case has been going on for 10 years. The jury heard evidence of damages and gave answers to breach of contract and breach of fiduciary duty findings that showed that the jury believed that there were breaches of contract and breaches of fiduciary duty. There were pleadings. We filed a brief that the court granted an extension of time for. We filed a brief this week that explains this argument better than I can in the limited time I have. But there were distinct acts of wrongdoing on the part of the Willises. There were distinct and separate injuries and separate and distinct damages. The jury came back and gave damage findings that were less than were argued for in closing argument by trial counsel. Trial counsel asked for, I think, $2.8 million and in a very quick argument said, breach of fiduciary duty, the same. But the jury didn't come back with an award of 2.8 or whatever the number was. It came back with this very precise number of $1.707 million, and it goes down to a 30-cent number. Those damage findings are rational. The trial court entertained much briefing on this issue, much argument on the damage issues for almost a year post-verdict, and allowed a recovery of breach of fiduciary duty damages, which clearly were separate and distinct from breach of contract damages for the reason explained in our briefing. The fact that the numbers were the same probably is a reflection of the fact that counsel said the same. That probably is true, but that is not a reason to remand this case for a new trial on damages, the Willises request. That would be a waste of judicial resources, of the 3 weeks of trial, of the nearly 1 year of post-judgment briefing, and the 6 years of appellate work that we've had in this case, because the Willis's only argument is look at the numbers. But the numbers are rationally based. The damages for breach of contract are based on expert testimony that the value of the stock of this corporation, if you don't include the real estate, is about $1.7 million. That's where the breach of contract finding came from. The breach of fiduciary duty damages was supported by evidence in the record of, I did it this morning when I woke up, of about $2.55 million in corporate opportunities that were usurped by the Willises, including this real estate, which had a market value of at least $2.436 million at the time of trial, as well as $1.8 million in tax benefits that Mr. Willis used for himself, as well as $300,000 in rent that the Willis paid for themselves from the corporation, and some other damage numbers that are referred to in the Court of Appeals opinion and in our briefing. And it would be a tremendous waste of judicial resources to remand this case for a new trial when there is evidence that supports the findings. When the trial court and the Court of Appeals looked very carefully at this record and found that there was evidence that supported both findings, there's an example in the restatement of judges in which restatement of judgments in which a party owes someone money. My time is up. I'm sorry.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Your Honor's on the statute 5.14L. It doesn't matter if it's effective. The statute says that you could get rid of the prerequisites to bring a derivative claim and bring it as if it's a direct claim, but it still has to raise the kind of duty that's raised in a derivative claim. The statute's entitled Derivative Claims, and it talks about in a close corporation under paragraph L, it says that in a close corporation, if certain protections for creditors and other shareholders are taken care of, you can have bring it yourself as a shareholder, but you have to be bringing what amounts to, as far as duty-wise, a derivative claim that you then can act like it's a direct claim. And how do I know that? Look at the ALI statute that they quote in their brief at page 28, and they say this statute's just like the American Law Institute. Listen to the language there. They could treat it as a direct action if it raises derivative claims. It raises derivative claims. And what's a derivative claim? That's where there's a duty owed directly to the corporation that the shareholder is bringing. Look at the cause of action that was submitted to this jury. This jury was not asked, did Mike Willis breach a fiduciary duty to the corporation? They were asked, did Mike Willis breach a fiduciary duty directly to Mr. Donnelly, directly to the individual shareholder? And Chief Justice asked, what's the limitation on the oppressive doctrine? The limitation is, if you look at all the cases, including Willis versus Bodoc, it's an injury that's alleged to the minority shareholder that's not shared by the rest of the corporation. In Willis versus Bodoc, the shareholder, the minority shareholder, was locked out. That's not an injury to the corporation. That's an injury to him separately. Now, as far as the equitable title doctrine, Your Honor, their equitable title doctrine argument is also inconsistent with the measure of damages that they want for breach of contract.
Well, did you preserve error? Did you submit a substantially correct
on
measure of damages?
On the measure of damages?
Yes.
With respect to the breach of contract measure of damages, Your Honor, the Court of Appeals doesn't even say we didn't preserve that. I mean, even the Court of Appeals said we made a specific charge objection that said you have erroneously charged the jury to calculate breach of contract damages based on the other matters relating to shares, and that provision doesn't apply. And the Court of Appeals on its face said, well, you can look at it and see it doesn't apply. That's clearly preserved.
And how about the breach of fiduciary duty?
On the breach of fiduciary duty damages, Your Honor, it is preserved because we again argued that the measure of damages submitted, that there was no measure of damages submitted and that there needed to be a measure of damages, and that we did suggest language. We made a request that would have been a fair market value type measure, so we think that is preserved. But, Your Honor, just going to counsel's argument about it being the same damages, remember that the Court of Appeals said the fiduciary damages were the value of the real estate that Mr. Willis purchased and the value of the loans. Look at the question that was put to the jury on statute of limitations on this. Did the breach of fiduciary duty occur prior to August 1993? And the jury said no. The jury said no. Look at the timeline. The loans and the real estate purchase, that all happened before August of 93. This jury was not answering fiduciary duty damages based on the loans and the real estate purchase. They said they weren't. And the Court of Appeals concocted that kind of out of whole cloth. Nobody was arguing that that was the measure.
Jumping back to the contract claim.
I need to go back to Justice Willis on the contract claim. You're exactly right. Mr. Willis scratched his signature line off, and in front of Mr. Donnelly, Mr. Donnelly admitted Mr. Willis wasn't signing. And Judge, Francie wasn't even there. I mean, Francie's name appears nowhere in that contract. There's no evidence in this record that contract was made on behalf of Francie.
Is there any record evidence that indicates why the Willis line was crossed out?
Right, because Mr. Willis didn't want to be personally, individually a party and responsible for the contract. And to answer another question that you raised, Judge, the contract on its face puts no obligation on Mike, certainly not on Francie Willis, who didn't even mention in the contract, to issue the shares or to pay Mr. Donnelly a salary. So you're exactly right. This contract on its face does not impose individually on either of the Willises individually the obligation for which they're being held liable for breach of contract without a finding of breach. Without a finding of breach. And Judge Willett, you asked the question of, well, isn't the whole point of incorporating to get protection from individual liability? That's exactly what this Court of Appeals decision flies in the face of, because it makes the controlling shareholder individually liable for breach of contract without a breach finding against them individually, without an alter ego finding. They're just automatically liable. That's why we believe the individual breach of contract claim against Mike and Francie Willis has to be rendered a take-nothing, and that the fiduciary should be rendered take-nothing because there's no duty owed directly to the minority shareholder.
Thank you, Ms. Yates. The cause is submitted, and the court will now take a brief recess.
All right.